educational session on fiduciary duties. Presented by Mr. Lederman.
Yeah, let me reiterate that last thing that Karen said. When in doubt, call Karen. Truly, you know, Karen, or if you want to call me, we are resources here to serve you. These are difficult issues that we all have to face. And this issue of the public records that Karen mentioned, the San Jose case is being argued before the California Supreme Court next month, December 7th, I think they've moved the hearing up. And that is the case where people in the city of San Jose made a public records request for the private email servers and the private email between city council members of the city of San Jose, because they said these are public records, even though they're housed on your Google account or your Yahoo account. And the city of council, of course, refused to turn those over. City said, no, these are private transactions, even though they're transacting city business on their accounts. And so the Supreme Court of the state will hear that argument in about 4 weeks, and we'll have a much better idea. I'm betting that they're going to find that it doesn't matter what medium you use, whether it's the State Department email or your own private email, that if you're conducting public business on a private email server, it makes it a public record of the agency. So we shall see.
Something like that, isn't it just the emails that pertain? It's not every email, correct?
What's that?
If they do that, do they want every email that you have?
Well, then you have to search everything. I mean, you...
That's a big fear. People are afraid they're going to get everything, but they're just asking for the ones that pertain to your business.
But then you have to start dancing through it, and as you see, torn right from the national headlines, who makes the decision that it's about my child's wedding or it's about
yoga
business or yoga or something like that? I mean, if your child's getting married and you invite David to the wedding, I don't know if you're available, David, but talk to Gabe afterwards. I mean, are you talking about businesses? You know, and who do you want to be making that decision? Some jury, a judge, commissioner, or something in Contra Costa County?
At that point, if you say I have 10 emails that pertain to that, and I have a total of 30, I give them the 10. That's all I give them now. Is somebody to come say I want the other 20?
Could be. Yeah, but why do you want that in your life?
You
know what I mean? Yeah, yes, it could be. It could make it very complicating. Think about all the emails. As Scott says, you know, we get 300, 400 emails a day. For how many days that you serve on this board? I mean, Scott's been on the board 4 years, something like that. You're going to have to go through and search all that stuff. I mean, what a... So the idea here is that, A, conduct your public business separate from your private affairs. Use a different system or server if you can.
In your basement.
And be careful what you write. I can't tell you how many cases I've tried where the key evidence blown up on the screen in front of the judge or the jury is an email. And it always comes back to haunt you. It's fascinating. It is. It's just really remarkable, David.
So I was advised to just set up a separate email account specifically for the Sarah business. So that I have that email account separate from my other regular stuff and anything I talk about.
Do we have Sarah accounts for Warren? That's something we really ought to think about doing, because it really helps segregate the business of what you're doing as a trustee or staff from your personal affairs.
Yeah, when I first came on talking to Gail and Karen, they recommended that you, so I set up a Gmail account specifically for Sarah business, and
that's great. Yeah.
But we did discuss that when I guess a year or so ago when we talked about the new website, that was supposed to be a part of that whole IT process, is that we would end up with Sarah emails, but I'm not sure really what happened to that.
We'll take a look at it.
Okay.
We'll have a serial meeting on that and get back to it.
Leave my number out of it.
So this is great. I appreciate the opportunity once a year. I think maybe it's been once every 2 years. This is my version of Paul's CI equals B plus E, you know?
Have you got a pen yet?
I don't have a pen, no.
Get a pen, I'll wear it for you.
I got to get a pen. I'll Paul print them up. It's good that we have this opportunity. We don't really take this opportunity during the normal course of board meetings, but things come up all the time. And I'm going to touch on, I want to get us grounded on the fundamental fiduciary duties. You should have two things that we circulated. One previously was the backup materials about conflicts of interest. We're not going to dwell a whole lot of time on that because there are a couple other things I really want to segregate for you and talk about. But I want to get us grounded basically on fundamental fiduciary duties. And then I want to spend a little time about the deliberative process because that really, for fiduciaries, that is the most important aspect of all of this, quite frankly. And then, you know, all the years that those of you have been on the board and been fiduciaries or served elsewhere as fiduciaries, you get imbued with this idea that, you know, you're handling other people's money, you could be liable, do we have insurance, you know, what's going to happen to us if we breach our fiduciary duties. I wanted to give you a snapshot. I'm going to go over a couple of cases, real cases, that have been decided by the appellate courts, to give you an idea of what gets you in trouble as a fiduciary for breach of fiduciary duty and what doesn't. I mean, that's almost as important going forward as what does get you in trouble. So I want to highlight a couple of cases for you. And then I want to focus on these three topics a little bit more. The whole issue of absences and abstaining, board member absences from meetings and abstentions from voting. Number one. Second, we'll spend a little bit of time on conflicts of interest. And then I want to spend some time on something that we haven't talked about for a long, long time, which is economically targeted investments, or otherwise known as ESG, environmental, social, and governance issues. That's something that the big funds talk about every day, and smaller public funds don't have the bandwidth to talk about much. But I want to get some, since we're in the process, and I'm glad Tim's here, since we're in the process of really chewing through the investment policy statement lately and what's in it and what's not and what our investment beliefs are and what they aren't, this is a good time to talk a little bit about ESG. Get you grounded. This is the CI equals B plus E of fiduciary duties. Our fiduciary duties are rooted in deep, deep, deep principles of trust law that apply to people like yourselves who manage other people's business and other people's money, not your own money, other people's money. When you take on the responsibility of managing other people's money, you take on the fiduciary obligations that are heightened obligations that are probably the strongest obligations imposed on anybody under the law. These are rooted in the California Constitution, which has adopted the fundamental fiduciary responsibilities. One is that the assets that you manage are for the exclusive benefit of members and their beneficiaries. That is your charge. You may not use plan assets to achieve other purposes or to accomplish the goals of someone else. This always puts people into a bind because you always have the question of what hat am I wearing when I walk through that door? And Candace has many hats. And you know what's fascinating is, as a supervisor, Candace, you sit on not only this board.
About 24 other boards.
24 other boards. How many of those other boards are you considered to be a fiduciary?
Not very many. Right. They're policy, more policy-driven, yeah. But I'd have to start analyzing them. Yeah.
You're right. No, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, but this is a unique responsibility here that you don't have with many of the other boards that you sit on. But you must have a hat rack at home that's, you know, Figuratively, I don't know about
my
literally.
iPad, my figuratively speaking iPad with my Dropbox with many files.
Yeah. You got separate fiduciary iPads.
Yeah, I probably should.
It's going to be, but there. I mean, there's a perfect example of how many hats, and and Jerry, for example, with the retiree group. But when you walk in this door, your fundamental fiduciary obligation, is to use the assets of the system for all the members and beneficiaries of the system. And that is your primary loyalty, to act in their best interest, not to serve the interests of others, not to serve the interests of the county, not to serve the interests of the firefighters necessarily. It gets hard, of course, because they are members, right? They are. The county is the primary employer and the primary funder of the system. And Rusty wears that treasurer hat, mm-hmm. and is always thinking about the fiscal impact on the county. But that doesn't mean you can't be loyal or have or want to see what you do in your day job succeed. It just means that when you walk in here and deal with the issues that are on our agendas, this needs to be your first and foremost liability.
Harvey, are you going to build in ESG?
Going to do that, yes.
With this, good. Okay.
Yeah, so this is a teaser. This is just sort of to get us, this is the gyroscope. Then we'll talk about the wind conditions and the surf conditions that buffet us as we go through, and ESG is one of them. So once you sit here, what standard are you held to in terms of performing your duties? It is literally called the prudent expert standard, not a prudent person standard. And we'll talk about that a little bit more, because you are supposed to conduct yourself the way a prudent expert would, someone who's familiar with the matters that come before you. And you need to arm yourself with expertise. And if you don't have it yourself, you need to go out and acquire it. That's why you delegate to investment consultants and you delegate to staff, for example, to bring you the expertise that you need to meet, to act under the circumstances as a prudent expert would, who's familiar with these matters in the conduct of a similar enterprise. The effort here, this is a lot of words, and I want to come back to it, but the effort here is to try to create an objective standard, not a subjective. It's not that you have in your mind that you want to do good and you want to do the right thing. You have to go beyond that. You have to do objectively what an intelligent expert armed with data, how that person would act in similar circumstances if they had similar goals that you have. It's trying to set up an objective standard in that way. The Constitution has added the duty to diversify the portfolio. The state of California, people of the state who passed the constitutional amendment on this, bought into modern portfolio theory. That is, the best way to minimize risk and maximize return for the benefit of the system is to diversify the portfolio, unless in certain instances it's clearly imprudent to diversify. So if it's under ordinary circumstances, your charge is to diversify the portfolio, and that's why we do an asset allocation, we look at charts about the so-called efficient frontier, and we weigh standard deviation as a proxy for risk, and we talk about risk, because your job is to maximize return but minimize risk and find a balance in there. And that's baked into your fiduciary responsibilities. And finally, there's the overarching question that Jerry has.
Yeah, we just, this number four was just heavily discussed over the last year, and we changed our investment policy based on FFP, which was completely different, but it's it diversifies the funds. But this was an example of when we have to put that hat on and think of what we're doing.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's a risk-based adjusted portfolio, and you will constantly. I'm gonna jump a slide ahead a second. About this prudent expert thing, does this have a dot on it? Right here. See this 1, 2, 3, 4th bullet point, chevron, under the circumstances then prevailing. This is baked into the Constitution and into the 37 Act. What you do is you bring your intelligence, whatever you can gather and bring to the table, to make a decision, for example, on the asset allocation under the prevailing circumstances. You're not a guarantor of the outcome of those decisions. You have to go through a good deliberative process to come up with a responsible decision under the prevailing circumstances. And those prevailing circumstances that we've talked about with the FFP asset allocation in the investment policy statement include the maturity of the plan, the cash flow of the plan, the volatility of the markets that are anticipated. So we take all that into consideration and then come up with something where under these circumstances we believe will pilot that path between risk and return that we're obligated to pilot.
Harvey, on the same token, on point number one, the exclusive benefits rule, I think the one that jumps out at me most often when we consider that is the assumption rate and developing an assumption rate, what we develop as policy for our assumption rate. This last time around was a real example to me that not always the rule you learn at first becomes a rule in effect 10 years later. And point taken is we lowered it to 7%. And I was always of the opinion when you lower the assumption rate, you're increasing the cost to both the employer and the employee. Yeah, it helps guarantee our fund in the long run, but you're raising the rates. And in fact, that did not really happen this time. It did not raise the rates, at least this last year, for the employer. It raised it so slight for the employee, I doubt that it'll be noticed. So. I guess what I'm saying is that was a good example for me of the exclusive benefit rule, of being prudent with the beneficiaries and making sure the beneficiaries of the system are going to be rewarded by the efforts that we make.
It's a good example of why you shouldn't try to reverse engineer the funding decisions of the system. You shouldn't come in here having in your head a actuarially assumed rate of return and then make everything work towards it. I see an awful lot of actuaries who say, I'm going to give you a rate of return that you can then allocate do your asset allocation to match. That's tail wagging dog. That's not what you do. The assumed rate of return is supposed to derive from how you've set your asset allocation with your comfort level of what you believe is that risk-return balance that you're willing to take. Everybody has a different tolerance for risk. And so then the actuary should say, okay, I see this is what you've set it at. This is what the capital markets projections are going to be. This is what the demographics are and people living longer and salaries, which is why if you try to do it the other ways, you don't come to the conclusion that you thought you were going to come to, as you said, Jerry, mm-hmm. because the fact is by the elements that reduced the assumed rate of return, part of that was a reduction in the projected inflation of salaries.
Right.
The reduction in the future projected benefits based on what people are going to make 20 years out went down more than the impact of reducing the rate. So don't come in with a preconceived right. notion and then try to work the numbers out to get to that notion. Your responsibility is to set that risk-return balance as a collective group. That's another part of this.
One point on that as well is, as we walk through some of the assumption changes this year, we didn't include in the packets, like, okay, if we do this, this is going to reduce or increase rates by this amount or this dollar amount. And we did that intentional so that, you know, we're not reverse engineering the process, that we're having a good discussion and that we have good fundamental reasons on why we're changing it. And we're not just trying to get to, you know, this certain dollar impact on the plan.
A lot of that, we sort of trust that the actuary is going to give us the best data out there. That's why I look at it a lot of times. I don't want to second guess what they're doing since they're the experts.
Well, that's exactly what we did, though.
Right.
I mean, I think it's fair to say, because this was a world I did practice in, that the actuary isn't the one that picks the assumed discount rate. It is a combination of the employer client and their investment team, advisors, et cetera, which was universally the way it worked in the world I came out of. And it seems to me to be the appropriate one, and that's what Harvey really just described. The actuary doesn't pick that, but the actuary is probably the one most knowledgeable about things like future inflation, and, you know, just because they work in it all the time, they're dealing with a series of funds, they do research on it, there are various studies by actuarial umbrella groups, et cetera. So some places the actuary's input might be the best you get, and in some cases it really isn't.
And you have to be careful. We'll talk about one of the cases I want to mention is about unreasonable reliance on experts. I mean, ultimately, you are charged with setting the assumed rate of return and contribution rates. And you do it on the basis of the expertise that people bring to you, but it can't be an unquestioning acceptance. The 37 Act specifically says the board shall determine the contributions based upon recommendations of the actuary. So it's very important as to who has the responsibility. And the Constitution says the board is responsible for assuring the actuarial soundness, I'm paraphrasing, of the retirement system. The actuary doesn't have that responsibility. The actuary comes and leaves and goes out and leaves you with having to make the decision for better or worse. We'll talk a little bit more about process, but I want to move ahead. On this slide, whatever number this is, six? No, five, I think. What I want you to take away from this is that, and you'll see from some of the cases I'm going to cite to you, it is the deliberative process that you go through that is more critical than the answer you come up with in terms of discharging your responsibility as a fiduciary. So let's talk about some of those. You know, how do I get into trouble? I've had this conversation with a lot of trustees who say, you know, I'm so tired of listening to you talk about fiduciary duty. You know, when am I ever going to get sued for this? I mean, honestly, really, is somebody going to sue me for this, and do we need insurance? And it doesn't happen that often. It happens rarely. But let me give you a few instances of where fiduciaries, both public and ERISA, private company fiduciaries, have gotten sued, and see if we can triangulate a little bit about, you know, where is the chalk line? Where do you step out of bounds, and where are you okay in bounds? The first case is the classic case. This is when New York in the 70s was near bankruptcy. Frankly, it was bankrupt. It just didn't file bankruptcy. And the city had no capability of raising money for bonds. City came to the city pension fund and said, will you make us a loan? Now, those of you who are fiduciaries would say, oh my God, the plan sponsor is asking for a loan from the pension fund that they're supposed to be contributing to. That's got to be a no-no, right? Well, the answer in this case was, it wasn't a no-no. New York was in desperate straits. The pension fund looked at this as an opportunity to do two things. One, to make a reasonable return on an investment, but two, to actually help keep their plan sponsor solvent for a brief period of time so that it could get back on its feet. More importantly, the court that heard this, because retirees sued the pension fund, the New York City Teachers Retirement System, and said, you are violating your fiduciary duty. You're thinking more about the city. This is the exclusive benefit rule. You're thinking more about the city than our retirements. You're jeopardizing our retirements by making the loan to this deadbeat city. And the court said, slow down. Let's see what process this board went through before they decided to make a loan to the city. And the court examined in great detail what process the retirement board went through and what protections they wrote into the loan documents, and at the end concluded that this was a prudent exercise, that the board considered the pros and cons, put in protections, had public hearings on it, and went through all those steps that a prudent fiduciary would do. And ultimately, something as so little arm's length as making a loan to your primary plan sponsor passed muster, and the court said you did not breach your fiduciary duties by making that decision. Really a very, very important case. Couple other ones out of the private industry. The Feel case, State Street Bank. State Street Bank was the administrator of the General Motors ESOP. And, you know, back in 2009 when the markets were tanking, as you know, General Motors stock went down, plummeted. State Street continued to hold General Motors stock heavily in the employee stock ownership program. State Street was sued for being imprudent in making that decision. It was a classic stock drop kind of a case. But the appellate court said they did not violate their fiduciary responsibilities. Why? Because State Street had a very detailed process, triple tiers of evaluation, of going through, and they employed that process and went through the evaluation of the likelihood of General Motors stock being overvalued or undervalued and how much was being held in the ESOP. In other words, they went through a strong deliberative process before they made the decision, and the court said you did not breach your fiduciary responsibility because of the process you went through.
Harvey, did it come into play? An ESOP is designed to hold employer stock and cash.
Right.
Those are basically the two.
Still under ERISA, it has to pass the fiduciary prudence rules.
Even
then.
What would you invest in? I guess you could invest in cash.
Cash.
Okay. That has to be the...
So that was the question. You know, should they have continued to load up on General Motors stock when they saw the stock plummet?
But the basic concept of the program, it says do that.
Well, it says do that or hold cash.
I would, you know, because I did deal with a number of those. My guess is the underlying direction of the plan. Obviously, I don't know the precise word.
Well, the whole intent of the plan
is to hold employer stock.
Employer stock.
So we did what the plan said we had to do, would be my reaction.
Still, they were responsible as independent fiduciaries to make a decision there and not just set and forget.
Okay.
No. So that's the issue. But the key takeaway is process. The Sprint ERISA litigation, it's the shareholders case, some liability. You know, in a lot of corporate pension funds, corporate officers sit on the 401k administrative board. So they have these two hats that they wear. And this was the failed merger between Sprint and WorldCom, and Sprint's stock value went down. The trustees got sued for breach of fiduciary duty. A lot of them were considered to be insiders, and a lot of them were the independent trustees of the 401k plan. And they got sued for co-fiduciary liability. And the question was, could they be held liable for the violations of the insiders, who were wearing two hats and probably had a conflict of interest in holding Sprint stock? And in that situation, the court said, yes, we're going to let this case go to trial, because if you know or suspect that some of your co-fiduciaries may have conflicts of interest, you have an obligation not just to sit there and let things transpire. You have an obligation to do something about it. And so, therefore, you can be liable as a co-fiduciary for violations of fiduciary duty owed by your co-trustees. David just got worried.
Directors covered under their insurance policy?
Were the directors covered?
Right.
Yeah, probably. Probably under their corporate policy. I'm not sure whether it was. Usually what happens in these cases is once the court on these type of busted merger or stock drop cases, they're class action cases, once the court says they have legs that can go on and to trial and they can certify a class, they settle. And this one settled, of course. Here's one. This comes back to Gabe's point about can't we rely on the actuary because they're the experts. Transportation Workers of America, big union, national union, they had the trustees of their pension fund had engaged an insurance broker to make personal insurance contracts available to the workers. The broker turned out had no idea what they were doing, misrepresented the insurance policies as having the non-termination clauses in them when the insurance company could actually terminate them. Broker was on the dole, had a conflict of interest. More importantly, the trustees simply went to this broker because they were familiar with this insurance broker and made no investigation about whether they were any good or not, and simply adopted the recommendation of the insurance broker. The court said that they were liable for breach of fiduciary duty because they didn't engage in a good deliberative process in selecting their expert, so-called. And you can't just take somebody who claims to be an expert and hire them without evaluating the quality of their expertise. So there was liability for not engaging in a good deliberative decision-making process about hiring the broker, in this instance, or hiring the expert. This next case, Nasrawi, this is dear to my heart. We are involved in a companion case. This one is for the Stanislaus County, one of our sister county retirement systems out in Modesto. Stanislaus had Buck Consultants as their actuary. Buck blew it, ended up creating or not discovering a substantial unfunded actuarial liability that later hit the books just at the same time as the market tanked in 2009. Retirees, Nasrawi and others, sued the Stanislaus Retirement Board for not suing Buck for malpractice as an actuary, and said that the board had breached its fiduciary duty by not bringing an action against Buck Consultants. By the way, other systems had successfully brought actions against Buck before this came up in Stanislaus in 2009.
Prior to the lawsuit, did anybody request the board to do that?
Yes. Yeah, and there was a lot of talk. And we were privy to that conversation because we were counsel to the retirement board. And the lawsuit went up to the Court of Appeals. And the Court of Appeals, and this is really important for all of us here, the Court of Appeals said that when you are making a discretionary decision like that as to whether to bring a lawsuit and you're considering the pros and cons, the likelihood of success, what you might recover, how much is it going to cost you to recover it, those are quintessentially discretionary decisions. And as long as you can show that you went through a good deliberative process, you are immune, both individually and as a board, under the Constitution and under the government code, you have immunity from liability for those discretionary decisions that you make. That case just came down last year, and it's a really, really key case. It's on point under our constitutional provision and under our 37 Act. Sister retirement system gives me great confidence that if we engage in good decision-making processes, that I can assure you that you will not be held liable either personally or as a board for breach of fiduciary duty unless you abuse your discretion. Same thing happened, by the way, put here, the San Mateo High School District sued the treasurer of San Mateo County a couple of years ago, and the county itself for holding on to Lehman Brothers bonds. Rusty may remember this. They held Lehman Brothers bonds when Lehman Brothers tanked. And they were sued for breach of fiduciary duty for making those investments and holding those investments in the Lehman Brothers bonds. And the appellate court ruled last year that they did not violate their fiduciary duty because they had the discretion to make those kind of investment decisions, and you can't hold a treasurer or the county liable for making those kind of investment decisions. So the point of all this is, I think it's pretty obvious, you're not the guarantor of the outcome. You can't guarantee that if you invest in Lehman Brothers, it's not going to drop like a stone, or General Motors stock, or what that outcome is. So long as you engage in a good deliberative process and then keep looking at it, keep doing it. The Tibble case out of the Edison International case, it's a U.S. Supreme Court case 2 years ago, specifically says you can't just pick your investments. You know, tell Tim, go ahead and invest in ABCDEF and then just set and forget it. You have to look at it periodically. Circumstances change. Go back to the phrase in the Constitution. Your job is to make judgments under the circumstances then prevailing. And when circumstances change, you need to change and re-examine your portfolio. And if you do that, you'll be in good shape. The last thing I put on here, of course, you know, obviously, if you take money from other sources, from investment managers, or you make decisions that are made for your own personal gain, as we now know the CEO of CalPERS, Fred Buonarroto, did, and some of the folks in the city of San Diego did in the Lexan case, that's just absolutely on the wrong side of the chalk line. Personal gain is an abuse of your public office and is a breach of your fiduciary duty.
Harvey, I don't want to go back one, but one thing my biggest struggle is maybe the topic before is when we make decisions how it impacts the sponsors and the members. We cover that. So we make a decision that's going to affect plan sponsors, budgets, and members. And I know we run a fine line be saying we've got to keep this thing solvent, yet we can't be, you know, going with that.
Yeah, it's a tough thing. You know, they put in the constitutional provision in that exclusive loyalty to members, a subordinate duty to minimize employer contributions. Interesting how that came in. That has absolutely nothing to do with keeping contribution rates low. That phrase came into the Constitution when Prop 21 passed in 1984. Prop 21 was the bill that allowed our retirement systems for the first time to invest in public equities. Before that, they were clipping bonds. 1984 was the first time we could invest in equities. And when the legislature created Prop 21 and put it on the ballot, they were worried that we would start gambling in the markets at the expense, because the plan sponsor, the county, is the guarantor of the benefits. And there was a worry that we had to balance the access to going into the public equity markets with, you know, people playing games at the roulette wheel of the stock market. And so they added this language that there is a subordinate obligation to minimize employer contributions. That doesn't mean keep near-term contributions low. It means don't take outsized risks at the plan sponsor's expense. And so we are always balancing. You know, we went through the Depression, 2009, 2010, and the markets were in the tank. And it hit just at the same time that real property tax revenues for our plan sponsors were dropping as well. Didn't have to be based on the housing market, but the market drop was happened to be based on the same thing that was hurting the plan sponsors. And so we were faced with, well, how do we send them a bill? How do we work in the tech, you know, the contributions that have to go up with a plan sponsor who's unable to pay right now? And so we, you know, we had corridor funding things, and we had smoothing, and we used all these techniques to try to not kill the goose that's supposed to be laying our golden egg. Ultimately, you have to fund the system. But it's a balance, and it's a difficult balance, and it's the toughest thing that all of us, all of you as trustees, have to do, which is why you make these decisions collectively. We're not like New York, where the controller of the state of New York is the sole trustee of the state pension fund. And I want to talk about that a little bit in the next couple of slides. This is supposed to be the collective judgment of all of us around the table. And you all come from very different backgrounds, wear different hats outside, and you're supposed to come together and make those balancing things, and it's not one way or the other, and it's going to vary from time to time. The county's ability to pay varies from time to time. Today, real property revenues are probably pretty strong in the county. How long that'll last, who knows? But circumstances change, and you're always going to be making that balance, Gabe. And there's no easy. That's why we revisit it every year, and we do an experience study every 3 years to recognize that those things will change.
Harvey, before you move on.
Yeah.
So this secondary duty to minimize employer costs, I just want to be clear. There was no intent with that language to imply that we should look for ways to switch the costs from the employer to the employees.
Oh, absolutely. I had absolutely nothing to do with that.
Great. Thank you.
That was not the intent. Okay, that segues us into, now you know what you're not going to get sued for. I want to talk about three things in varying degrees because this is an opportunity to talk about the fiduciary implications of them. The first one that I thought might be relevant to us is this idea that Scott Gordon asked me. No, he's...
Yeah. He left his pad, didn't he?
Or did Where is
he
Scott?
He's recording it.
So the first thing is absences and abstentions. Absences from board meetings. And when you're at a board meeting, abstaining. And, you know, why do we care? And what has this got to do with fiduciary obligation? Well, I was just alluding to the fact that the design of this board is unique. This is considered an interested board. And that's the way all of our California retirement boards are established. Different states, different places. Ontario Teachers is always kind of held up as this model pension board. There's a board that's made up entirely of appointed individuals who are supposed to be experts in the field of investments and finance, banking, that sort of thing. That's a different model than we have. As I mentioned, New York, the controller of the state is the single trustee of the entire state pension fund. We do things differently in California, much more democratically. We've constructed this board to have this balance, active member, you know, elected people elected by active members, people elected by retirees, alternates, possibility of a supervisor sitting on the board, the county treasurer, other appointed private industry people, all coming to make a collective decision. That is not only the fundamental design of the board, but the Constitution specifically says that you can't change that design unless you go back to the people of Contra Costa County and get them to change it. That's how important that balance is seen on our board. This board is very unique, as you know from talking to all of our folks, friends at Sackers. We've got alternates and alternates for alternates. Okay, we have a lot more alternates here who can fill in when someone is absent from the board. A bill just passed in this assembly session that gives additional power to the safety alternate as well. A lot of boards don't have any alternates, well, except the fire and the safety alternate. We also have situations where the treasurer, because you sit, Rusty, as ex officio, if you can't attend a meeting, you're allowed to designate somebody from your office to come in. But the idea is that there's supposed to be balance on the board. What happens when somebody's absent? When a board member's absent and there is no alternate to take their place, you deprive the board of some element of the diversity that it's designed to have. So that's why we care about that. The same thing with an abstention. If you don't have a good reason to abstain from voting, you are essentially pulling your vote off the table and no longer engaging in the obligation as a trustee. The Constitution is written in active verbs. The board shall, the board does this, the board does that. It's a signal to you that you as a trustee are supposed to have an active role in the administration of the pension system. You can't have an active role if you're absent or you're abstaining from a vote. Now, there are times when you need to abstain from a vote. If you have a conflict of interest, you need to recuse yourself, and that's clear. But there are times when you may be tempted to say, I want to duck this one. I don't want to be on record voting on this one or the other for whatever reason. That's not a good fiduciary response. You get paid the big bucks for a reason, right? But the key here is that you're supposed to actively engage as a trustee because this is supposed to be a collective balanced judgment. And the public policy is very strong here that you should be present and voting as much as you can. A number of my client systems have board policies that specifically say if you miss more than two meetings that are unexcused, for example, that the board has to excuse them, or you can be stripped from participating in committee memberships or being chair of the board or something like that. There aren't a lot of sanctions you can level on each other. You can't fine each other. This is a good governance issue. So when you have, for example, a choice of attending a board meeting or going to a conference, we should either talk about moving the board meeting, or you should think long and hard about, do I really need to go to that conference, or should I be in my board seat at the time? Now, there's always going to be conflicts that come up, but this is something the board itself could establish policy on. You could say, you know, we encourage, we strongly urge, whatever language you want to use. The key here is that you're supposed to be making these decisions collectively and together, and there's a very, very careful balance on these boards that we want to maintain. So think about it. Anybody have any questions on that?
Who would challenge somebody abstaining where there may be some view that abstention is inappropriate?
Well, there's always the possibility that, let's suppose we ended up with a 4-4 vote, for example, because of an abstention or an absence. something passed or didn't get passed or didn't get changed or something like that. It's possible that someone could sue some interested party. A stakeholder could bring a suit and claim that there's a breach of fiduciary duty because the board failed to act appropriately. There's strong case law for the proposition that a trustee of a trust, a fiduciary of a trust, has an affirmative obligation to take action. And so it's possible. It's not likely, John.
So this would be somebody that you're envisioning here outside of the board.
Yes.
Suing the board or suing the individual board member who abstained?
Both.
Could be both.
Let's take, let me push that example a little bit. We are obligated to transmit to the county every year in advance of the next fiscal year, or usually there's a delay of 18 months, the next set of contribution rates. And suppose this board, because of an absence or an abstention, is incapable of doing that act that it's required to do under state law to come up with the contribution rates based on an assumed rate of return and other actuarial assumptions, that we just can't do it and we don't do it. I could see someone bringing an action that says you're in derogation of your responsibilities because you've deadlocked. And this is a 9-vote board. It's not supposed to have deadlock. Welcome to the Supreme Court, I guess.
Yeah, really.
So. I know we had other questions of Harvey. I thought I saw hands go up, David.
Well, if you abstain because you're really not sure, if it's kind of a coin toss, do you just do the coin toss? Or if you really are stuck in between and can't decide one way or the other, is it best to say, you don't vote? Or if you don't feel like you have enough information, these things come up and so
That is really a good question that we all grapple with. If you don't have enough information, there's an obligation that you get enough information. That's actually a statement. If a board member makes a statement like that, that I don't feel like I have enough information, that should trigger the chair or somebody else saying, wait a minute, what do you need? What more do you need so that you can participate in this decision? And maybe we need to postpone the decision if that's something that we can't get our hands on right away. We can't send Tim back out to go bring back an answer about an investment or something like that. That's really very important because if one out of the collective 9 can't make a decision because of lack of information, it's possible that others are in the same situation.
So it is reasonable to say, I feel we need to postpone this vote until I can.
You might get voted down, but I think that is a great question to ask because so many times you feel like I guess I'm the one who doesn't know, or all these people know things that I don't know. They know all the jokes by numbers, and actuary yells out a number and they laugh. And I don't know what it means, but I don't want to look dumb to ask the question. Time out. It's really important to ask those questions. Very important to ask those questions.
When the 1937 acts were created or any time after, was there any thought to standardizing like what's pensionable compensation, amortization years?
Anything? Supposed to be. We're struggling with it.
I would never have thought that all are going to have the same laws written.
It's supposed to be, it's designed to be uniform across the 20 county systems. But my God, I don't think there's a benefit decision or a funding decision or an actuarial decision or anything that in how to handle COLA and whether to use December to December or whether to use calendar to calendar. I mean, that's a discretionary decisions. You're never going to write a law that is so specific that it can be uniformly applied by different political entities. It's just be nice, but then you go to Sackers and you find out other systems do things completely different. Okay, can we move on?
Somewhere, when there's a good break time, not too far down the clock.
We can take a break now.
Is now a good time?
Sure.
My sense is it take 5+ minutes.
Great. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Recording paused.
Yeah, absolutely. Mr. Lederman.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, no further questions on that. Seeing none, hearing none. I want to talk about conflicts of interest very briefly, though, because we've talked about that a lot over the time. But I want to highlight a couple things. If you go to your other hymnal, not the slides, the backup, the outline.
Number 6 on the program?
What is it? Is that on the agenda?
Yeah.
Yeah. Jerry, show that around, will you? So everybody's on the same page. That's the outline. I want to point out a couple of things. You have, and attached to that is Exhibit B, that's, if you look, I hand wrote page numbers down at the lower right-hand corner so you can follow along that way. You have a code of fiduciary conduct and ethics. You also have a conflict of interest code for filing documents that need to be filed, Form 700, for example, with disclosures. What I really want to draw your attention to, if you go to page 8, with the handwritten number on the lower right of the pages, that should be a page that's part of our fiduciary conduct and ethics code. Starts at the top, each member of CSERA's board, we all on the same page, huh? Right. If you go down, let's see, 6 paragraphs down, and then the 7th paragraph. 6 paragraph down says, each member of the board shall strive to avoid activities which may impair the ability to exercise independent judgment in the discharge of official duties. That's really what it's all about. I mean, the rest is fleshes this out, all the rest of the pages of conflict of interest laws and that sort of thing. And go to the next paragraph where it talks about maintaining the highest standards of conduct and ethics. Each member of the board should conduct official and private affairs so as to avoid giving rise to a reasonable conclusion that he or she can be improperly influenced in the performance of his or her public duty. So those two paragraphs, independent judgment and avoiding improper influence on exercising your judgment. I can't say it better than that. And you don't need to read anything more than that. So all we need to do is keep in mind that those are the talisman that should govern how you conduct yourselves as fiduciaries and trustees of the system. Just as simple as that. And any time you feel in your heart of hearts, in your mind of minds, that there's something leaning on you or some reason why you have other considerations than the exclusive use of these assets for the benefit of the members and their beneficiaries, a flag should go up. And you should ask, can I be really independent on this? Can I exercise? This is what is asked of you as trustees. Independent judgment, not influenced by outside considerations or by your own personal interests. The rest of it you can read through here. It's in granular detail. The conflict of interest laws are so complex. And for those of you who run for public office, Candace, Rusty, Deborah, I mean, when you layer on that the campaign rules and the lobbyist rules and all the other Fair Political Practices Commission regulations, the gift rules and all that stuff, it
it could really crush you. It could keep you from doing anything or even wanting to be in the public eye. But they're there for a reason, because we want to be able to trust our public officials. You all are public officials. I'm going to touch on that again when we talk about ESG. But the fact of the matter is, it's a matter of trust. That's why you're called trustees. And if the public's going to entrust you with $12 billion, where are we now?
7.7.
7.7 billion. Wow. Get to work, Tim.
He's down in LA.
12.
Wow.
A guy can only hope. $7.7 billion that you're entrusted with. You know, this is the standard we have to live by. Unless there are some specific questions about conflicts of interest, I'd rather leave you for home study on this subject and move on to something that we haven't had a chance to talk about at all yet, but I think is important. And if you'll bear with me, I'd like to open up the subject today. But any questions about conflicts of interest or concerns that you may have? Gabe?
I have three of them. On page 6, as you can, there's 6 on it, says we have the NC PERS code of conduct. What's the purpose of that in there?
That was adopted. I mean, and this board believed that NC PERS model code was a good model, and instead of reinventing the wheel back in 2003, the board said, "Yeah, me too."
Okay, and what if the NC PERS changes that? Are you going to change ours?
No, I don't think so. Unless you want to. I mean, obviously.
It would be NC PERS code of ethics at that certain point in time, kind of thing.
Right.
Okay. Then on,
I mean, this is a recital. You know, technically, it doesn't come after the now, therefore, be it resolved. So this is a recital on which the board's resolution was based. It was basically, it's a preamble. So technically, it's not part of the binding resolution. The binding resolution of the board follows after the preamble.
Yeah, I hadn't really noticed that, but I was just...
Yeah, interesting. But it was a good thing to say, wow, this is a pretty good model. We should comport ourselves consistent with that.
Okay. And then on page 9, four down, where it says, if a board member or designated staff receives GSSA powers or more in that paragraph. Now, let's see if Varis comes and talks to us about our business, and we've done a couple of business dinners, one over 75. We have to say each board meeting when Ed Scott's going to speak that we've had, you know, $7 or more worth of dinners with them.
So I can take that one.
Go ahead.
Over $50, I know this says 75, over $50 you have to report on your Form 700.
Right.
This particular provision in the board's code of ethics is disclosure to the board before they make a decision that involves the person who might have provided the trustee with $75 or more of something, a gift. And so, for example, if you had somebody's coming up, an investment manager, for example, is coming up, there's a recommendation to engage in a transaction with them and hire them, that's where you would need to disclose your gift. For example, had to do with Varis, and they are the investment consultant for the board. So in connection with entering into a contract with Varis, you would have to make that disclosure. But if Varis is now here at a board meeting and giving their recommendation as to investment, asset allocation, or whatever else, that doesn't trigger that same.
Okay.
Karen, if they bought you a lunch for $55, you have to report that on your $700, but you don't have to report it to the board in connection with an engagement.
Correct.
Okay.
And then on the number 4, the prospective vendor consultant advisor for the quiet period, which I always use an email Tim gives us. So how does that go with Varis? Because that one kind of a fine line, because I know they're on the quiet period yet. Obviously, we have business going with them. So how do you just not talk about, let's say, the emerging markets piece of it or something?
That one I'm not really clear on.
The quiet period would apply to a search for a new vendor or a new manager. So since Verisk has already been hired by the board as the investment consultant, there wouldn't be a quiet period applicable to your communication with Verisk.
Actually, I think, Gabe, are you referring to the private market search where Verisk...
I'm sorry, I said you already were private market, right?
So an existing vendor is bidding on a new service. How do we handle something like that?
Because Verisk is on the email that Tim put out.
They're bidding to run money for the system.
Right.
So okay. you couldn't have communications with them, or you asked them a quiet period, yeah. So no communications with Verisk about that particular aspect that they're running for, bidding for. You do have in this policy elsewhere another provision that says if you already have a vendor that you retained, the board is able to continue to communicate with them generally because they're still providing a service to you. Just the quiet period would apply to only that area of the market or whatever that they're running for.
Right. Okay. Thank you. It's 4B on the top of the next page. Then.
Okay.
Yeah, there it is. So page number 10 in the handwriting page numbers at the top, it talks about existing vendors. So Verisk is your existing vendor, and you continue to have business meetings and discussions with them, with current vendors and consultants, because they may provide useful information of benefit to the board.
So basically, we would not talk with them or anybody else. We have companies that are in existing business, but they're also in the RFP process quite pretty. We just wouldn't talk about, let's say, private market as an example.
Correct.
Right.
Okay. That's all I have. That does raise an issue about whether if they're your sole consultant and they're bidding for other business, who do you consult with? But. Okay. Let's talk about investing. I want to talk about impact investing, ESG, or Environmental, Social, and Governance, ETI, Economically Targeted Investments, Socially Responsible Investing, all sorts of things we hear about. We haven't engaged. The reason why this is timely is that we're going through revisions to our investment policy statement. And the investment policy statement previously did include some provisions, a couple of provisions relating to economically targeted investing. There's a question about what the board wants to do with those now. But generally speaking, I want to try to give you a context because it's been a highly contested issue elsewhere. Most systems, the size of this system in the 37 Act, don't spend a whole lot of time talking about divestment decisions or targeting specific underserved communities, for example, for investment. It comes up from time to time, but quite frankly, it requires active engagement and personnel, and we just don't have it. And the board hasn't made a decision, an active decision, to say we want to focus on this. But there are issues that come up from time to time, and I want to give you a fiduciary context so that going forward we can consider these issues to the extent you want to consider these issues. ESG investing, this idea of investing or not investing in a target industry or market, it goes back a long time. I think in terms of modern issues, it goes back 20 or 30 years, maybe even more than 20 years, with the boycott of companies doing business in South Africa so as not to support apartheid. At that time, the whole concept was that even though public pension funds are fiduciaries and supposed to have this laser beam focus on financial performance, that there are some issues that are so overriding in social consciousness that that legislatures, for example, can ban us, should put constraints on us from investing and making money off of things like apartheid. they were not originally analyzed for their financial impact. They were analyzed for their ancillary purpose, social purposes, good governance purposes, public welfare purposes. And there was little effort initially to try to say, well, there's an economic consequence that may impact the portfolio. That's changed, and has changed a great deal over time. It changed specifically in a big way with the idea of divesting from the tobacco industry. Because for the first time with tobacco, the projections, remember I talked earlier about making decisions under the circumstances then prevailing. Well, under the circumstances that were prevailing 20 years ago when tobacco was being considered as an, you know, admitted beyond doubt evil that was killing millions of people worldwide, it was believed that the tobacco industry was going to be a colossal failure because of that, that sales would plummet, that markets would shrink, that there would be massive litigation against Philip Morris and Lorillard and British American Tobacco and all those companies, and that investing in these businesses would actually be an economic drag on the portfolio, and as a consequence, we should project under these circumstances and projected circumstances, we should make a decision to divest from these companies because they will have a significant economic impact to harming our portfolio. That was a sea change in the concept of ESG, that is investing for environmental, social, or good governance reasons. Looking backwards, we're now learning that the tobacco industry turned out to be pretty damn resilient, more than anybody ever thought. Number one, they diversified into all sorts of other things. In fact, I think just yesterday I saw the British American Tobacco was acquiring Reynolds Aluminum. Wasn't that what it was?
It's not aluminum. It's Reynolds Tobacco. But
yeah. Oh, I thought it was aluminum. I thought, well, you
nope,
know.
Nope.
I was wondering, you know, that's going to make for a very hot cigarette. Okay, I'm glad you cleared that up for me. You got to put the foil in the cigarette. They used to, yeah. But the idea, you know, when looking backwards, the question was that a good decision at the time to have made to get out, you know, for that reason? But as I said earlier, you're not the guarantor of the results. You make a decision based upon the circumstances that are presented to you at the time. And if it doesn't turn out that way, it's not your fault, and you didn't breach your fiduciary duty by making that the investment decision. But the issue here is, can you consider these environmental climate changes is clearly the one that's on the table right now, fossil fuels and global climate change consequences. Is it appropriate for a fiduciary to consider these kind of things when making investment decisions, or do you need to focus on purely improvable economic consequences? The Department of Labor regulates all the private plans in the United States, the ERISA plans, and we look to Department of Labor guidance for fiduciary rules where we don't have rules that apply to our public plans. The Department of Labor, every time they're in the eighth year of a two-term president, the labor secretary who's about to leave office drops a new ESG bulletin on it. When Clinton was in his last year, his labor secretary, Robert Reich, issued his interpretation and sort of left it for the next administration. Then Bush did the same thing. His labor secretary on their way out issued an interpretation that constricted, or appeared to constrict, the ability of fiduciaries of pension funds from considering ESG issues. Now we fast forward to the end of the Obama administration, and Tom Perez in the Labor Department last year just issued, on the way out, a new guidance that seemed to broaden the ability of trustees to consider ESG issues as part of the concept. This is all sort of a lot of inside baseball. Let me try to give, and you've read a lot about it, and you see a lot about it maybe at SACRS and other conferences. Really what it comes down to is this. The Department of Labor is saying two things. One, ESG issues really do have potential financial impacts on investable assets and in markets that you invest in. And so it is appropriate to consider the economic consequences of these various things. And that's why divestment from illegal firearms, for example, is an appropriate consideration, because if you look at what's gone on in the business, the regulation, and the lawsuits, just like tobacco, there is a concern that the value of these entities will drop. So that's one thing. It is appropriate to take into account the economic consequences of these issues. Climate change is another example. There are businesses, Exxon Mobil comes to mind, for example, that will indeed have substantial amount, it's projected, of stranded assets, mining rights, drilling rights, that will be left on their books because the global demand for polluting fossil fuels has shrunk substantially, except in China and India. But globally, that demand has shrunk, and therefore your holdings are going to be subject to constraints that otherwise wouldn't be there. So it's okay to take those into consideration. The other thing the Department of Labor says is that if you've got two managers, for example, global macro managers or something like that, that otherwise have the same profile, the same experience that you're looking for, the same strategy, the same conviction, the same track record, they're very comparable, and you're trying to make a decision, that it's okay to tilt the scale to the one that you believe engages in good governance principles or is more economically, environmentally sensitive or more socially sensitive than the other one. So as a tiebreaker, it's okay to consider these kind of issues. All those are interesting. I think that's such a hypothetical that it never comes up. So the Department of Labor talks about this tie-breaking thing. But as a practical matter, those in the business will tell you, we never come down to a decision that's like that, where there's some tie-breaker involved because they're socially conscious. One is more than the other. What I want to add to that, what the ERISA standards don't do is recognize a significant difference with those of us who work in the public sector than those of us who run private plans. It is true that you owe your fiduciary duties, and this is your overarching fiduciary duty, to steward the assets of the system for the members' benefit. And you can't sacrifice the projected return of your portfolio to favor some policy or other that benefits others, whether it's the public welfare or something like that. But here's where ERISA doesn't go far enough, in my opinion. For those of us in the public sector, you are public officials. Every time you are appointed to this board, or whenever you're appointed to this board, you raise your right hand, I guess it's your right hand, and you swear an oath. The California Constitution requires you to swear an oath to uphold the Constitution of the State of California as a public official. part of the Constitution, the biggest part of the Constitution, the key part of the Constitution is that the state of California exists to protect the health and welfare and property rights of the citizens of the state of California. So in addition to your constitutional obligations as a fiduciary to the members and beneficiaries of the system, there should also be some recognition that you don't have in the private sector, that you are a public official who has a concern, supposed to have a concern, with the public's welfare. And that is something that all the regulations at the Department of Labor don't come close to talking about. This is important enough of a distinction in my mind to bear out the other, you know, it's Article 16, Section 17 of the Constitution that has all these provisions about your fiduciary duties. That same article, that same section, subsection G, that follows directly after giving you the exclusive plenary responsibility to shepherd these assets, also says that from time to time the legislature may find a public issue so compelling that it can ask you to limit your investment in certain assets, so long as you find that that is consistent with your fiduciary responsibilities. So that has happened. The California legislature has done that on a couple of occasions. It did that with investing in companies that do business in the Sudan and in Iran. Before that, there was affirmative action for companies doing business in Northern Ireland. Last year, there was a bill that asked our public pension funds to divest from investing in thermal coal companies. There was another bill for divestment from illegal firearms. There was a law passed to encourage the state systems to invest in public infrastructure. So not just a divestment, but an actual targeted investment. There is a provision that says that our state pension funds should consider credit enhancement, investing in credit enhancement vehicles for California municipalities. So under this same provision that gives you your exclusive fiduciary authority is a provision that says the legislature can ask you to consider environmental, social, and governance issues so long as you find that they're consistent with your fiduciary duty to the members and beneficiaries of the system.
Question?
Yeah.
So the sentence, you may not sacrifice returns solely to benefit other causes or interests. Let's say we have a situation where, like, tobacco looks like it's going to have a 20% return. It's like, this is, you know. But the members of CICERA, of the association, retirees and active members, come up with a petition, and a majority say, regardless of the return potential, we do not want this money invested in that entity. I don't know if that's ever happened or not, but...
It's happened.
What do you do with that?
Well, what would you do with that? Let me throw that back to you, David. How would you handle that?
I love the idea of earning 20%, but the other costs to society and given the concerns of the membership, if that is a majority of the members of the association, then that would sway me.
That would be material to you. So it raises a living example of the struggles that a number of boards go through in exactly this situation. Now, there's a reason why trustees are put in place and the beneficiaries are not put in place to be the trustees of the system, to say what's in their best interest. And we have a varied group of beneficiaries and members. We have current active members. We have retirees. We have future members of the system, because it's a long-term thing. So they may have different views. It'd be very unusual to have all active and all retirees sign a petition that says, we believe you should do X or not do Y. But the fact of the matter is that this is not a trust run by majority vote. So what you want to do with that, because you're a trustee, is that you want to take that into consideration when you're making these determinations. There's all kind of things that weigh in this. When you say, well, we're expected to make 20% on tobacco. You ever seen, Tim will show you maybe in the next meeting, you ever seen, I had an example, the periodic chart of investments, of different investment styles. You see, it's not even copywritten anymore. And basically, it takes, you know, U.S. domestic equity, U.S. Fixed income, emerging markets equity, and gives them each a little color and a thing, and then it charts how they did. Of course, they're all projected. You take the efficient frontier, and they're all across the efficient frontier. You know, you're supposed to make more here. More risk is more return or something like that. The fact of the matter is it's impossible to predict. You could have invested in commodities in 2005 and made a killing. The next year, commodities was the worst performing asset class in anybody's portfolio. You wouldn't have predicted that. So when we make predictions, number one, about a particular segment of an industry of the broad markets, and say this industry is going to outperform, so we better jump on that, you're probably not going to make an investment decision based on that anyway, going into that. But there are a lot of things that you have to take into consideration when you take an industry like tobacco and say, I'm not going to invest in it. First of all, how do you do that? How do you do it mechanically? How do you instruct your managers who are indexed against the S&P 500? To say, well, now you got to be indexed against the S&P 500, but you got to take Lorillard and Reynolds and all those out of it, and you know, so there are issues related to that. What I'm saying, without going into a lot more detail, is it's a very complicated question. When you make a decision, when you consider making a decision for reasons that are not specifically economic decisions, you have a whole bunch of considerations that you have to take into account. And I'm not suggesting at all that you don't take into account the feelings or the desires of your membership. Not at all. What I am saying is that today, in the mature investing markets that we have the capability of dealing with, that it is now possible to take into account these kind of issues in ways that we didn't have the tools to do 20 years ago. I'll give you an example. We talk about one of the obligations, fiduciary obligations, is to diversify the portfolio. We now have opportunities to diversify the portfolio into social and environmental sensitive investments that are specifically structured to recognize these things and to not disrupt your portfolio construction. State Street Global this year came up with what they call the SHE Index. And it's essentially, it's an index constructed of S&P 500 companies that have a significant representation of women on their boards. And they back-tested this index to see if we had picked these, you know, 5-10 years ago, how would this have performed against the broad market? And it turns out that the correlation is pretty good. It's pretty close, or it would have outperformed the market. And so you now have the opportunity to invest in something that has, arguably, a low tracking error to the regular index market, but would allow you to emphasize a development of corporate governance that you might like to take into account in structuring your portfolio. MSCI has 12 different indices now where it favors or disfavors certain ESG issues. Goldman Sachs makes custom indices. There are green bonds. There are all kind of public and private funds. All of these are constructed because there has really been global pressure on pension funds, particularly, to take into account these various issues while not harming the portfolio, if that's possible. And because it's so impossible to predict what the market's going to do anyway, it's very difficult to say, well, you know, if I only limit myself to investing in companies that have 20% representation of women on their board, am I going to be harming the portfolio? Our portfolios are broad enough to be able to accommodate considerations like this if you wish to make them. And that's really all that my message is today. I'm trying to address the issue of, can a prudent fiduciary take into account in making its investment decisions various considerations that it believes are material to acting in your capacity not only as a trustee but as a public official in the state of California? Candace?
Has there been any analysis, particularly of smaller pension funds such as ours, of what the cost to really be in compliance with these policies? And when I was up at the California Retirement Association back in up in Sacramento last month, you know, CalPERS was talking about the millions and millions of dollars and number of staff people they have ensuring that they are in compliance with these certain guidelines, whether it be behind the scenes, making sure the boards reflect the type of people they want on each and every board, if they're going to invest in it, making sure that nothing is, I mean, as I listened to it, I thought millions and millions of dollars of this fund are being spent solely just to say we want to comply with this. And you know, some of the index funds you've just suggested can help you get away from that. But how many small funds really have embraced these policies, and how many full-time people does it take to really ensure compliance?
Yeah, very, very, very few smaller funds have the capacity to devote their energies in this area. However, collectively as investors, and this is where organizations like NCPERS or even at the state level, SACRs or CALIPERS, could collectively provide services available to it. There is clearly the large funds who are the biggest investors in the United States. CalPERS and CalSTRS are the two largest, you know, investors in the United States. So they not only have the clout, but they believe that they have the responsibility for the long term to promote the kind of corporate behavior that will demonstrate improved performance over time. There is a strong belief that responsible corporate governance with a recognition of the impact of diverse boards, for example, can have on performance, avoiding certain inappropriate investments can have on performance. There is a strong belief that corporate boards that are democratically elected and appointed and have good compensation programs for their chief executives lead to better results, financial results, and that over time the portfolio will be enhanced by that. And therefore, the money that they're spending administratively to police and go out and influence boards and engage with boards is an investment as part of, it's an investment expense towards an improved performance in the future. Very few funds under, at least public pension funds, under $50 billion in assets have the bandwidth to carry out those kind of programs. Deborah?
Harvey, you mentioned there was a global pressure, I think the words that you used, global pressure to to consider, at least consider these ESG policies. Where's that pressure coming from?
Well, let me give you one example. The United States is a signatory to the Paris Accord. The Paris Accord mandates that the United States will adopt policies that will restrict greenhouse gases to a certain level over the next 50 years. That means that the United States government is going to be imposing regulations or creating incentives on industries in the United States, many of which we invest in. So there's a global example of how our investment portfolio can be affected by a policy that the government has signed on to.
So the Paris Accord was a gathering of the United Nations countries. Basically, it was put on by the United Nations. My understanding is that there's an organization called Principles for Responsible Investing.
That's right.
Which is a United Nations organization that has really been the center of all of this ESG. And so, for me at least, it makes me wonder, is it really the United Nations who is presenting this to us?
It's hard to know which came first, the chicken or the egg. We are, the United States public pension funds have lagged behind the European counterparts in terms of embracing these kind of issues and their influence on portfolios. The Europeans are way ahead. Ahead, maybe, I don't mean that other than directionally. They have moved to embrace these kind of policies more than the U.S. pension funds have done. I don't know if it started with the United Nations, but at this point there are so many organizations out there that believe that this is the future and that we need to recognize that this future will have an impact on our investment portfolio and need to either embrace it or get out of the way. Because it's going to increase. And the Paris Accord is just a perfect example of how that is being imposed upon us whether we like it or not. I think the Paris Accord has now been accepted by sufficient countries that it will be binding, and it is binding on the United States unless some future president or Congress decide that they won't be bound by it. So my point is this last bullet point, ESG factors that are intended to avoid harm or promote health, safety, and welfare are proper for you to consider, especially where there are alternative investments available that can be integrated into a diversified portfolio. And to that, obviously, we would look to Tim and Varys and, others to give us guidance in that. And they can do economic analyses and projections on what's available. So my message to you is it's possible to harmonize these. I'm not trying to suggest in any way that you need to supplant your economic analysis of the portfolio's performance and expected performance by an overlay of social goodness. What I am suggesting is that it is possible to accommodate and influence the portfolio in ways that take these considerations into account if you wish to do so. And now, one of the reasons why I'm bringing this up now, let me go back. In the prior IPS, we did have a few provisions in there that perhaps we need to put back before the board to consider what you want to do with them. On economically targeted investments, we had the statement, it shall be the policy that ETI can be considered if and only if it has a return and risk characteristic attractive in comparison to other alternatives. That it has not been carried forward, right, Tim, in the current version of the policy statement. The same thing on emerging managers. It's the policy of the board not to exclude managers. This is kind of a motherhood and apple pie. You know, we don't exclude you just because you have a mustache or a beard. But so that has not found its way into the current investment policy statement, and there should be, that should either be ratified by the board or not, I think. And then tobacco, we had a specific provision in the investment policy statement that said that we will not hold securities in a company that derives 15% or more revenue from tobacco products. So we really should make a decision about whether to carry that forward or what to do. Not fair to leave the investment group hanging as to whether or not that is their charge any longer.
I thought we already made this decision when we rewrote the investment policy. No?
So just a framing exercise from my perspective here. The investment staff and the investment consultant are always tasked with bringing fiduciary framed financial guidance to the board. Anything that we consider to be extra financial, including these are not something that organically come out of the investment decisions. This is where we need board guidance. You know, in the absence of board guidance, we're going to do what we think a prudent expert would do. We're going to operate within the bounds of the law, but if there's additional guidance from the board wants to express, such as on these three, we need that to be an explicit expression from the board. When we were crafting the investment policy statement, we came back to the board and said these three pieces are out there as legacy pieces that past boards had made. And the question was put to the board, do you want us to draft an investment resolution to carry these forward? And the response from the board was, no, we do not wish to carry those forward as explicit investment resolutions. I think from Harvey's point, they're still kind of hanging out there as these legacy issues. They're not in the new policy statement, but there are decisions of past iterations of the board still on the books, so to speak.
Well, I just wasn't aware of this, on tobacco divestment, since that was in our policy, and I take it we carried that out in our policy, I'm not aware that the board has made a decision to stop doing that and to reinvest in tobacco. That was not my understanding. I don't know if that was your understanding. What was your understanding?
This is where we don't have a great degree of clarity. It was asked not to bring forward the new policy. However, that language is also embedded in individual manager contracts, and there was no express direction from the board to change those legacy manager contracts.
So I think I would suggest that we get some clarity on this issue and that we, you know, put it on a future board agenda for consideration, at least on that one. The other one is that, the other two, I think will come up from time to time. You may want to adopt, or maybe you've already said, no, we don't want to plug those in. But in terms of the actual investment of the portfolio, if the portfolio is currently X tobacco, I don't want to back into a decision that reinvests in tobacco. I want the board to make a decision in that regard.
Recall, we didn't want to put restrictions on our decision making.
That was the discussion we did.
I'm sorry, say that again.
We didn't want to put restrictions on our decision making. We would make those decisions collectively, but not because we had to based on policy. That makes sense.
Okay, well, tell me then, tell Tim, when he hires a new domestic equity, you know, I have a domestic, give me an example. When he hires a new global manager, are they instructed not to invest in companies that have 15% or more of their operations in tobacco or not?
No, they're not. Under our current policy, they're not.
This is not part of the current policy.
This is not.
A new manager would not be subject to this restriction.
We have this discussion.
So the question now is, do we need to formally rescind, if they were not carried forward in the new investment policy statement, do we need to formally rescind these past actions?
Of the current managers that were signed up under these past actions?
And I'll put that to Harvey. In terms of, if they're not carried forward, they need to formally retire.
Well, if we have managers, even under current contracts, if we've changed our investment policies, then we need to instruct our current managers as well as future managers. as to their holdings, whether they're subject to these restrictions or not. So I think we need to, I would recommend that we tee this up for a board in public session.
Harvey, this has been running through my mind as you've been describing this. 2 or 3 years ago, I was at a Sackers dinner that included a trustee from another plan, not our plan, but reasonably similar in size. And in her position, with a great amount of animation, was that it would be a wonderful investment for their fund to invest in low-income housing for their county, mm-hmm. because that low-income housing was good. They could even give them, no doubt, a slightly better rate. Life would stay at home as opposed to investing somewhere else. And I, as I watched her do all this, the real enthusiasm was building the, from my perspective, was building the low-income housing, not for maximizing return to the fund.
Right.
We did have that conversation, and she absolutely assured me that her crystal ball said that this was absolutely as good as alternative investments, maybe even better. This was a very quick response that didn't require lots of thought. When you get to that kind of a point, what is it you now do sitting in our role as trustees? And this happens to be a real live one.
Well, there for most counties, there always is a push to invest locally. And sometimes board members come on out of various private industry, for example, and say, you know, we really ought to be investing in this county's real estate because it's a good investment, and instead of putting our money into Sri Lanka or something like that. I mean, you have to vet that as an investment decision. That's what you want to do. And make a determination. Does
any conflict with a board member who has that degree of
could
enthusiasm?
I mean, it could be. It depends if the enthusiasm is based on the fact that they own the right of way of the developable property they're talking about.
I'm assuming that was not the case, by the way, not in terms of personal.
But no, I mean, everybody comes to the table with certain thoughts, but that's why this is a collective decision, not one person's decision. And so that would have to be vetted in the ordinary course as an investment decision, and you would want to follow your standard investment guidelines and procedures for making a decision about whether that's an appropriate investment for the system. I wouldn't shut it off necessarily simply at the suggestion phase. It may well be that after vetting it and talking to your outside investment consultant and other people that you're advised that, you know what, Contra Costa Real Estate or low-income housing really is a good investment here because there's a strong market for it. So I wouldn't shut it out entirely, but I'd be really careful to make sure nobody's got a personal financial interest involved in that.
I was just thinking, rumors tobacco companies will start investing in marijuana as it becomes more legal. So that kind of opens another door. If you're in favor of marijuana, you may say, now I want to invest in it. They're against marijuana, all
right.
To, so I can see that
coming up. Oh, I'm sure that's going to be in our portfolio if it's legalized in California. It probably already is in our portfolio from other states. I don't know. What do you think, Tim? You don't want to say that publicly. Gail says, are you kidding me? It's bad enough the cigarettes are going to be wrapped in aluminum, huh?
Well, years ago, we had a board member that was uh-huh. into socially responsible investing, and that's what he, even though the returns weren't as good, he still wanted to invest in socially responsible stuff because that was, his company did it and wasn't invested in his company, but that's what he believed in, was investing in stuff like that.
So wasn't John Gioia you're talking
no,
about?
No, no. No, it wasn't John.
He passed away. Peter Cameo.
Okay.
Yeah.
Peter Cameo when he was
on
the board.
Yeah.
He was really into social responsible investing.
So we should bring the issue, and maybe staff will talk offline about how broadly to bring this back up. But at least if we currently have instructions out to managers relating to tobacco specifically being excluded from the portfolio, we need to have a specific determination as to whether we're continuing that or not.
And if so, it should be consistent for existing.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I want to make something clear. Our investment managers, they do have copies of our new investment policy statement. That's something that we typically obviously do so that they're aware of any new restrictions or guidelines that we have.
Yeah, they're actually...
Our investment managers do.
They're bound by it. I mean, most of our contracts say that they will abide by our investment policy statements.
Yeah.
So that's good. So that's pretty much it for from me for this year's fiduciary training. Any other questions on that? I appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.